We are moving through the Stations of the Cross. If you haven't been with us, and that's what these posters are all about. I just love the way that the words are being projected onto the posters, because it's like we can't help but notice them that way, right? And you can figure out the words if you can't. Try a little harder. We today are focusing in on two. Jesus Falls and Simon Carries Jesus' Cross. And so if you get a chance to take those in, or take all of them in, this is an artist from Portland who did this publicly on the outside of a building where commuters were going by, as sort of his public art expression of the storyboarding of Jesus' life. And so today we're focusing more so on number 6, but to get us kind of in the mindset of number 7, there's a little video I want to show. And it's based on the passage that kind of gives us a little bit on a character, but not enough to really know much about him. This fellow by the name of Simon of Cyrene. And if you remember the story, as this is how Luke tells it, as they led Jesus away, a man named Simon, who was from Cyrene, happened to be coming in from the countryside. And so the soldiers seized him. He was just coming in to Passover from the countryside. Soldiers seized him, put the cross on him, and made him carry it behind Jesus. We don't get a lot more details than that. So there's an actor that's decided to try to imagine what that would be like. We're going to show that.
Passover lamb. But we didn't understand that. When I got to Jerusalem, it wasn't what I expected. I mean, there was like 10 times more people there than the last time that I'd been there to celebrate Passover. And it just seemed like the whole city was angry. Mobs of angry people. And all of a sudden this guard, the soldier, he grabs me. I mean, he literally just pulls me out of the crowd. And he says, "For me to carry this guy's cross." If this guy's blood, it's on me, it stains me, and I can't celebrate the Passover. That's the whole reason I was there. It was hard to see the man through the blood. And then our eyes met. And I knew this man was not a liar. He was not a crazy man with grand ideas. He was the Messiah. I carried what I could, but he carried most of it. We began to walk. I heard the insults that they shouted at him and now at me. I felt his spit. I felt his blood on me. They'd taken a crown made of thorns and then they smashed it on his head and blood ran into his eyes. They laid him out on a cross. And they nailed his hands and his feet to it. And they lifted it up. And he had all of his weight on that one spike through his feet. And he would push up with all of his might. and gasp for a breath to stay alive. I couldn't watch it. He did that for hours. I couldn't watch it. And I looked down, and I remember seeing my hands. My hands were stained with his blood, the blood that I thought would make me unclean. And I realized it's the blood that makes me clean. He breathed his last breath. Then he died. And that was the day that I helped Jesus carry. That was the day that I helped Jesus carry my cross. He hung and died on my cross.
We're doing something wrong if it's not intense. I love the switch at the end. They died on my cross. So, Father, as we open our hearts to this storyboarding of the last week of your life on earth, we invite you to make it our story today. In your name. There is a podcast that my wife and I love to listen to called This American Life. Are we turning the lights back on? Are we good? We're good? I think we're good, right? And they zoom in on American culture, and they talk about it from usually four different angles, and that's why we like it. It's very interesting. It's very relevant to the things that we're thinking about, or sometimes not relevant, but still interesting. And they did one on a subculture that's developing in the U.S. In different parts of the world. They call it decibel drag racers. Have you heard of this? Decibel drag racers. And basically, these are guys and gals that they have cars and fill them with stereo equipment to compete to see whose car stereo can produce the loudest sounds. And so they call them decibel drag racers, and they get together and they bring their cars together the way drag racers would, except ironically, their cars can't be driven. Like they're just giant subwoofers now, basically. Like they're just housing stereos in them, and they compete. The current champion at the time that this was on the radio anyway. Had filled his van with 900 pounds of concrete in the bottom so that it would resonate better. And the other irony, the thing that, the number one, it's a car that can't be driven. And when they compete, the sounds that they're going for are so intense they can't use music. They just use like a tone. So it's a stereo in a car that doesn't do either of those things. It's not a car anymore, it's not a stereo anymore as far as how we would think about it. But it's evolved to this thing where people are competing, and so they don't drive the cars, they're hauled on trailers and so on and so forth. And what I loved was at the end of the show, the guy that was describing it, he says, to anyone outside of this extreme audio sport, which I think is also kind of funny. Irony is perhaps a generous word to describe the phenomenon. But listen to this. He says, however, everyone wants to be the king of a hill. He concluded. But the number of aspiring kings always dwarfs the number of available hills. So in this country, we just build more hills. Hear that again? Everybody wants to be the king of the hill. Everybody wants to be the best at something.
But the number of aspiring kings always dwarfs the number of available hills. So in this country, we just build more hills. Is there something in you that relates to that? To a desire to define yourself as something because of where you rank as far as king of the hill? Is there a capacity or a compulsion in you where occasionally you'll find yourself measuring yourself based on a pecking order of the people around you in your life and say, well, this person is such and such, and I'm partway there, so I guess I'm part of what they are? Or is there an ambition in you that says, until I can find my hill or create the thing that I can be known as significant for, I'm going to keep searching? The storyboard on the wall around us is the story of what people thought would be Jesus' movement towards becoming the king of the hill. And what we see, though, is that it's the inauguration of a kingdom. It's the inauguration of something new and bigger, but it's not the kingdom everybody thought it would be. It's this storyboarding of the last week of Jesus' life that describes him not stepping into what everybody imagined would be the nation of Israel's final chapter of it finally coming into its own, at least not the way they thought it would. But we also see that this is a storyboard of an invitation that Jesus is giving to us, isn't it? Of how he would invite us to abandon our pursuit of the king of the hill and to follow him into something really different. God, today as we open your word, as we look at this story, as we're moved by how it went down and how it affects us, we invite you to give us the capacity to feel and think our way through what it is that happened in that week. And ultimately, God, we thank you for the way that we can sort of zero in over this course of this series on different moments of that week. But ultimately, we invite that week to inform this week. And so we pray that what happened then would be something that could affect what's happening today and now. And so as we open up this story again, help us to not approach it as something we've heard 1,000 times or even 10 times, but as something we're inviting to speak fresh. So I want to put up the little scripture underneath the Jesus Falls, which is from John chapter 12, and read it together. It starts off, very truly, I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies. Actually, let's back up. We're going to put the whole thing on. Remember? There's a verse before that, which is 23. Let's see. No, there's a little before that. Okay, does somebody have a Bible handy? I'll go on the phone. Yeah, we need verse 23. This is what you call building suspense. I wish I could say we planned it, but we didn't. All right, let's see. All right, here we go. Jesus replied, "Now the time has come for the Son of Man to enter his glory." Okay? And hear that? Jesus replied, "Now the time has come," he's talking to his disciples, "for the Son of Man to enter into his glory." Now, this is a phrase that to us, we're like, what? Okay, so it sounds almost cryptic, like how we got to work our way through, like what this even means. But to the people hearing this, this was a direct quote from something that a dreamer, a prophet named Daniel, had promised would be the solution for their oppression. So if you're a nation that's been oppressed, if you're a nation that defines itself as being conquered, when your prophet, who's been writing on lots of other things, comes along and says how you're going to be vindicated, it's something you memorize. It's something that maybe you tattoo on your back or something. It is a big deal. So when Jesus says this, the anticipation starts to build in the room. He says, now the time, it's here. The time has come for the Son of Man to enter his glory. Now, if we go back to the reference, why don't we do that? Again, I didn't tell the media people, but we're going anyway. 7:13 in Daniel. It's the end of a dream that Daniel has, this vision where he imagines or dreams, or maybe God, I think obviously God's speaking to him. He sees these four different beasts. You ever had a dream like that? Hopefully not. But it's like this very vivid, awful beast dream. And it becomes pretty obvious that it's sort of connected to these different empires that have oppressed the nation of Israel, the Jewish people. And then at verse 13, it says this: as my vision continued, I saw someone like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the ancient one and was led into his presence. He was given authority. He was given honor. He was given sovereignty over all the nations of the world, so that people of every race, nation, and language would obey him. His rule would be eternal. It'll never end. His kingdom will never be destroyed. Jesus is saying, that's about to happen. Okay, so we have trouble imagining why, like, getting fired up about that phrase. But when he says, the time has come, the Son of Man is here, he's saying, it's time that the nation of Israel that's been oppressed all this time, we're going to start moping people out, and we're going to be on top. That's what they hear. Of course, then he gets into the next part, which let's put it up on the screen. Verse 24, you can kind of feel the anticipation, the excitement just sort of being sucked out of the room at the next part, because in their minds, they're imagining this conqueror coming. It's like he's going to be in charge of every empire. He's going to have complete sovereignty. Everything's going to be like he's the man. And then he goes, very truly, I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies. Like, okay, where is this going? You know, how's this coming around? It remains only a single seed, but if it dies, it produces many seeds. Like, okay, don't get the metaphor as far as moping heads here, but we're sticking with you, okay? It says, time's up. The time has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. We'll go to the next one. Listen carefully, that's the same one, but it's buried. Never on the grain of wheat, but if it's buried, it sprouts and it reproduces itself many times over. In the same way, anyone who holds on to life just as it's as it is, destroys that life. But if you let it go, reckless in your love, you'll have it forever, real and eternal. So I guess this is just a different version of what we were reading before. Suffice to say that all four people that tell the Jesus story, and catch this, come up with a phrase that's very similar to this. They all say, if you want your life, you gotta lose it. And if you try to keep it, it won't work, it won't be yours. If you want your life, you got to lose it, is what Jesus is saying here. And if this wheat has to be buried in the ground, it has to die so that it'll sprout many times over. And we see this theme in Matthew, we see it in Mark, we see it in Luke, we see it in John, where each of them say something like this. If you want your life, you have to be crucified daily, Luke says. Or John says, and this is in the Message, so it's a bit different. In the same way, anyone who holds on to life just as it is destroys that life. But if you let go of it, reckless in your love, you'll have it forever, real and eternal. And it seems like the guy who's supposed to lead the grand conquerors of Israel is saying he's going to die. And yet, a second ago, he said he'd be glorified. So how in the world does glorified equal crucified? For Obi's birthday this year, my son, he's 7, he decided to invite all the boys in his class, because who wants girls at their birthday, right? But, well timed. When you're 6 turning 7, we got his sister in, but that was about it. And so what he did is he had the boys over, And we had a friend of ours come and do something really cool. He brought his virtual reality setup. Has anybody tried virtual reality before? It's like you put on the goggles. Only a couple of you? If you get the chance, it's way better than you think it is. It's like, it's very real in there. And so the way that it worked with the boys is they put on the goggles, and they can see like they're in a whole other world. And it really feels like that. I tried it. And you kind of, it's almost, you feel a little nauseous at first sometimes because it's so real feeling, but your movements are kind of different than what your eyes are seeing. You know it if you try it. But the cool thing is that you can see on the television screen what they're seeing in their eyes. And so you can kind of watch, and it's interactive, so the guys are taking turns, and while Obi's playing, his buddies are watching him moping out boxes. So boxes are flying at him, and he's hitting them with this virtual stick. You know, so it's really also fun to watch the TV and, like, how ridiculous the person looks, right? Because they're in another world, swinging their arms around, like, and doing things. And this game is pretty simple, but some of them, you don't want to be seen playing virtual reality because you look nuts, right? But so he's playing, and all the boys played. It was a great time. They were really enjoying this other reality. So once all the kids were gone, we said, okay, son, you get one more try. So then it's bedtime. So he's playing on his own now. The party's over. And he's really getting into it. Like, he is winning this game. He's moping boxes, you know, left and right, and they keep track of how many boxes. Moping, by the way, is my word for destroying. and as this is going down, a new box comes that's for whatever reason, he's extra aggressively wanting to destroy. And so he's really into it, and he's facing the TV. You guys see where this, maybe see where this is going. And so he runs forward with his little handheld nunchucks to destroy this box. But we all know what's happening, right? We all know what's in front of him, but he's in another reality right now. He's not seeing anything. So he runs forward and smokes the TV, right? As hard as he can. For sure, kills the box in the game. Like, if that box made it through in his goggles, I don't know how, because he not only destroyed the box in the virtual reality, but he destroyed the box in the dad having to buy a new TV reality as well. And so it's over. You know, the game's playing on, but the TV is not. It's a cracked screen. It's done. It's over. Now, here's the thing. The game kept playing. He was winning the game. He was doing what the game asked him to do. He was destroying stuff in the game. But intuitively, probably because he felt it on his hand, he knew that something beyond the reality he was in was happening. He knew that something bigger had just happened, something like maybe Netflix is ruined now. You know, like there is more at stake to the actions he's just made than that the game has to stop. In fact, he's winning the game. He is doing what the game has asked him to do, and he's making it through. But he knew intuitively that the goggles needed to come off, and he needed to look at this TV, and bless his heart, 6 turning 7, he was crushed. He'd wrecked the family's TV, which he's probably one of the most passionate about in the family. But this is like this dichotomy between heaven and earth, between the things that are being lived out in earth versus the things that they're representing beyond just the earth. Okay? So get this as an analogy. So Jesus is walking through this world, and he's experiencing all of the wrath of humankind, all of the ways that we are awful to one another. And in this game that we play in humankind, we try to work our way up the ladder, right? We try to compete with one another. We try to remove God from the equation and be our own God, or figure out how we can live life our own way. And that really is the game of humankind, sort of the expression of the disease that we all carry, that as far as our relationship with God goes, we're more interested in living out a selfishness where we're pursuing things that make us feel good apart from God, and where the last thing we want to do naturally is say that you're God and I'm not, because what if you are asking something of me that I don't want? And it's almost like Jesus, and when he's confronted with this, he's confronted with this opportunity to lash out and start moping boxes and take his rightful spot as the conqueror of the nation of Israel. He says the way to beat this game is to realize there's way more going on than this. There's a whole other realm going on. And so he says, how about we just give up on this game? Because love doesn't have to win the game. He says, how about we die to this one? Because there's something greater, there's something bigger, there's something holistically better and more far-reaching that lies just beyond dying to the things that make this game so messed up in the first place. And so he inaugurates this. He says, the pathway that I'm going to go to be glorified isn't one where I play your game, humankind, where I reduce myself to sort of the earthly version of what conquering looks like. But I'm going to invite you into something that's bigger. I'm going to help you take the goggles off and realize the game that you're playing is dangerous. And it's a game that takes you away from God, who loves you and who's inviting relationship. Now, some of you might be thinking, well, okay, so I've heard the whole idea of denying myself or dying to things, and I prayed the prayer, and I know, like, all that is good, and I've... But that's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about this once in a lifetime we say, I'm sorry, you're great, I suck, now everything's fine. But we're talking about what Luke says about taking up your cross daily. This idea of daily saying, I'm no longer going to measure myself by the human game. I'm going to die to the pursuit that humanity traps me in. I'm going to let it go so that I can be rebirthed into a vision that's bigger than my tiny goggle reality that helps me see that way more is going on. And for those of us that have died to stuff, and experience how God makes us alive in new ways to those very things. We know it, don't we? We know that when we let some of those instincts that drive us die, the ugliness that comes from inside of us go, that it's replaced with something way better. This is what I think he's talking about when he invites us to follow. Okay, so maybe some of you came in here today with a problem, a real problem, something that is stressing you out, that you're feeling anxious about, that you feel like, I don't have a clue how God or praying or any of that could affect like a real 2019 problem. So what, do I die to my problem and now I no longer have a problem? Like, that sounds like kind of idealism to me. But what I like about the Obi analogy is that he's simultaneously in both zones, right? So he's in the zone in the game, but there's a zone beyond him that hopefully has more to say to him than what the goggles do. Okay, so many of us live trapped in the goggles, trapped in our version of what human existence and pursuit of things that matter looks like. But if we can allow God to let us die to that being the only way we see things and open our eyes to a broader experience of life, then it's not that we abandon the game and say, I don't live in this world any longer and I want nothing to do with anyone in it. You're all dead to me. I live in heaven now. You know, that's not what it is. It's this simultaneous weight on 2 feet, one in the kingdom of heaven, one in the kingdom of earth. And we navigate how to be an intersection point between those two places. And so we say, how then does my problem get addressed? How do I die to something? Something that actually is bothering me. Just dying to it isn't going to change anything. Well, the question we ask ourselves is in our mind, is it our responsibility, or are we playing out a plot line where we are the hero that fixes our problem? Are we the person responsible to make it work? There was Aaron and Ben and I just went to this awesome conference in Washington, D.C., and we had a little extra time, so we took the subway into the main part of Washington where the White House and all the monuments are. And there's a subway station called L'Enfant Plaza, and it's kind of the hub for the whole area where everybody goes to look at the what they call the mall, which is where all the monuments are. And I was thinking back to this story I heard that happened. The Washington Post put out a article, and the guy who wrote it actually won a Pulitzer Prize for it. But it was describing how one day in L'Enfant Plaza, this very bustling, busy subway stop, a guy by the name of Joshua Bell went in there in normal street clothes, wearing a hat, t-shirt, and jeans. But packing a $3.5 million violin, a Stradivarius built in the 1700s, like very expensive, like the best you can get. Now, Joshua Bell is also one of the best violinists in the world, and he plays for some, I was reading, and it said that he plays for like $1,000 a minute is what he charges, not what he charges, but that's how much he gets paid when he goes to some of these places. Which I'm thinking, I would love something that I get paid $1,000 a minute. Wow, that is some pressure though. So anyway, he goes into L'Enfant Plaza in street clothes. He pulls out his violin, he opens a case, he sprinkles a little change in there to see if he can busk and get some people to give him some money. And he starts to play, and this place like is when the train comes in, it sounds like thunder. Like the acoustics in there are crazy. I think it's because of how it's shaped and the material that it's built out of. But when we heard the trains coming in, it was thunderous. And so to imagine sort of that open, echoey space with a really proficient violinist playing a Stradivarius, like you can imagine, that would be a beautiful thing to hear, wouldn't it? And so they did it in the morning, and people were coming for their commute, and they were getting off the train, they were passing by Joshua Bell. And they said a couple things. One, every kid that went by wanted to stop and listen, without exception. But their parents were like, come on, we're trying to get somewhere. They said that I think it was 27 people of over 1,000 threw a little cash in there. But very few stopped to listen. And one guy recognized them. That's it. Now, what was interesting and what won them the Pulitzer Prize, I think, is that they had people outside of the subway station. They were kind of running an experiment. So they took people's numbers, and they said, we're doing a little article on commuting. Do you mind if we call you later when you're not busy? So some people gave them their number, and they followed up. They call them later, and they say, listen, was there anything different that you noticed when you commuted to work this morning? Was there anything you saw that was different? And people were like, yeah, well, there was a busker, I think, and you know, but nobody could really say much about what they'd seen. And so they started to write this article, and it goes all over the place about whether beauty is something that's objective or subjective. And then they asked the philosophical question, is it really beautiful music if nobody hears it? Like, does if a tree falls in the woods, you know, that whole kind of a thing. And, you know, whatever. But what caught me was the line at the end. I have it with me in case I forgot it. Oh, I remember it. The guy who wrote it ended the article this way. He said, they didn't... Let me see. They didn't expect him. That's what they said. They didn't expect him, so they didn't recognize him, so they didn't hear him. I feel like I don't even have to say anything else. Right? They didn't expect him, so they didn't recognize him, and so they didn't hear him. When we meet problems,
in our normal everyday living. We revert, at least I revert so easily to that human sort of MO of I'm going to figure my way through this. And without some sort of intervention in my thinking, the last thing I want to do is listen or look for where I would expect to see God's Spirit showing up in a way that I could expect Him and then recognize Him and hear Him in my problems. So, to end, I give you guys something that I'm asking myself that someone asked me, and I think it sucks. Okay, I'll warn you, it sucks in a good way and a bad way. But you know when it's like that stuff that works on you in a way where you're like, oh, I know this is good, but it's tough. What they were asking is, as we think about the Jesus story, Him exiting the powers of human pursuit and saying, I'm going to give in, I'm going to give up, I'm going to die to these things so that I can be raised into something that is a bigger version of this little imitation of life. I'm going to be raised into this bigger version of life so that I can have better impact on life. Okay, so that's the Jesus story, the way I like to tell it. What they said is, as we're invited in that same progression of dying to the things in our life that are really expressing the disease of our humanness, so that we can live in the freedom of the life God wants to give us in an abundant life, said there's three sort of stages we're at with the problems that come at us. Are they things that are before death? Before the cross, as some people say? Are they things that are before death? Are they things that we haven't admitted we have to die to yet? That we're saying, maybe they can sneak into the Jesus-following life, so I'm going to keep them. Are they, see, you can see how this sucks, right? Like, they're things that you have to face. So are they things that are pre-death, where it's like, they're not even on the table yet? Are they things that are in the process of dying? So you've identified that they're no good, that they're got to go, that they reek of the human disease of selfishness or getting God out of your life. So are they on the cross or in the process of being worked through? Or are they post the cross, where you feel like you have new freedom in those things? And so what I've been asking myself since I heard that, and it's not complicated, right? But it's to say, are there things that God is inviting me over this Lent season to look at that He's wanting to die? Are there things that are my striving or my rights or my entitlement? For my attitude that it's fine, whatever. That I have every justification under the sun to hold and to hold tightly. But He's asking, if you want to follow Me, walk the storyboard of dying to these pale imitations of life, and I'll give you something great. Nor are there things that are on the cross, are there things that you're in the process of dying to? Are there things that you can look at and say, that was something I went through, and wow, I should actually take a minute to sort of celebrate. Like, that is no longer an issue in my life. Here's where the Simon of Cyrene thing, I think, connects us to folks. Is that in the same way that Jesus walks through this, and Simon assists him, Simon comes along and helps him, Jesus says, I've laid out a pathway for you to move out of the worldly pursuits into something that's going to take you into a whole bigger version of reality that's better. I'm not just going to give you the pathway, though. I'm going to partner in getting you there. So it's a pathway and a partner when Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. I'm coming alongside with you to help you die to the things that are robbing you of what's on the other side of your problems. Lord, we thank You for this example. We thank You for the way that You have the foresight and the love center, I guess you'd say, to embody these things in such powerful ways. And I confess I so quickly just skim over the story. But as we slow ourselves down and think about the way that you decided to be victorious, we're inspired to think that you didn't play the world's game, that you died to it, that you allowed the dysfunction and the stains and the sickness of humanity to be heaped on you. Like it said in that video, you died on my cross. You died for the things that are my stains, the human stains. You didn't have them, but you allowed them to be the reason. And we thank you, Father, that in your love, you didn't leave Jesus in that state, but that you broke through and that you brought life despite what he carried. And so we pray that that would be our experience as well. We know that's the promise, that as we die to things that you alert us to, that we can expect a new version, a new opening of life, a life abundant that you describe, that isn't measured by the way we are moping out our problems, but that's measured by the way, once we've died to them, their new and beautiful things are birthed. And so where we're just on the cusp of understanding this in a way that would help us to apply it, we invite your Spirit to take us there, to help us apply this, to identify the things, not all of them at once, we know you wouldn't do that to us, but the things that are today's things that you would ask us today to go to our MO in the spiritual life, dying to the things that hurt us so we can receive things that give us a broader perspective. Do that in your name. Okay, well, we're going to sing, but as we do, invite you to just stay in that space. It takes me a while sometimes to get into a mode where I'm introspective and where I'm listening and where God is saying things. If you're in that space, don't allow the melodies to be things that distract you, but allow them to be things that enhance that for you. Okay, why don't we sing together?